Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, at the very top of the Bill of Rights, has hardly had it easy. For more than a century, it was observed in the breach. Today, the United States may have the freest speech on earth, but 9/11 brought new challenges to that freedom and how it's used. In a new book, Pulitzer Prize-winning master commentator and First Amendment scholar Anthony Lewis looks at America's record in defending the right to free expression. This hour on Point, Anthony Lewis on American freedoms and freedom of speech. With me in the studio is Anthony Lewis, two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize and former columnist for the New York Times. He was there from 1948 until 2001. He's a scholar of the First Amendment. His new book is Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. Anthony Lewis, it's wonderful to have you and have you back. Thanks very much for being here today.
It's great to be here, Tom.
So here you are, kind of a lifetime invested in looking at and exercising this freedom. You write really fascinatingly in the book about just what a hard time we had coming to terms with the freedom we'd guaranteed ourselves in the U.S. Constitution. It was an education for me, looking back again at how it stuck in the craw of Americans for a long time and how quickly we abused the very freedom that had been outlined by the founders.
Well, thank you for what you say. It is quite surprising. The amendment was added to the Constitution in 1791, and the Supreme Court did not decide a single case in favor of free speech or freedom of the press until 1931, 140 years later.
And it seems like only nanoseconds after it came in, looking back, I mean by the run-up to the election of 1800, we already had the Sedition Act, and the Federalists trying to suppress pro-Jefferson comment, pro-Thomas Jefferson comment, and they weren't kidding. I mean, they prosecuted 14 men all the way back then, among them editors of the Philadelphia Aurora, the Boston Independent Chronicle, New York Argus, the Baltimore American, the Richmond Examiner, you remind us. They really went after the press right away.
They weren't subtle, and their political purpose was sort of symbolized by the fact that the Sedition Act expired on the inauguration of the next president under its own terms, right. March 4th.
We'll use it now and not later.
Yeah. Once we take care of Jefferson, we'll forget about the Sedition Act. But they didn't. Jefferson won and pardoned everybody who'd been convicted under the act.
So how did it come to pass if we had a culture, a political culture, a time when people were so ready to ignore freedom of expression? How did it come to pass that the guarantee was written into the Bill of Rights in the first place?
Well, it's an oddity. I think there was a basic ideological premise in the American Revolution in favor of freedom of speech. The colonial charters of Virginia and other states had incorporated freedom of speech clauses, and so people were for it in principle. And Madison was certainly a tremendous and sincere advocate of it, a great believer in the role of the press in keeping government honest. But, you know, not only in 1798, but ever since, when people have seen stress or reasons for political advantage, they've put their belief in freedom to one side and said, well, just for now, we'll suppress a little.
Or suppress a lot. One thing that emerges very clearly here is, you know, people talk about going back to the Constitution, living only by the Constitution, strict constructionists and all the rest, but it's the interplay of judges, Supreme Court judges above all, and their times and the American people that lead to our understanding of what the guarantee means. And you look way forward to Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who you cite in the title of the book, talking about how we even have to guarantee the freedom for the thought that we hate. But that was by no means the first or early interpretation or understanding of this guarantee.
It wasn't the judges' understanding. They gave the back of their hand to all First Amendment claims until, as I say, 1931. Holmes wrote the first opinion celebrating freedom of speech. That was 1919. But it was a dissent. And it wasn't until 1939 that his views and those of his co-dissenter, Justice Brandeis, triumphed. What did they see that judges had not seen for more than a century when they read these very plain words? Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. So why did it take until 1931 to read what was right there on the paper?
Because judges saw it as not a very important freedom. They thought the Americans could take care of themselves and didn't need any judicial help. They said that speech could be abridged, could be suppressed, if it had a bad tendency. Well, of course, that's really no freedom at all.
What do they mean by that, a bad tendency?
Well, it just means anything that the government thought had a bad tendency. But the graphic and dismal example was during World War I, when thousands of Americans, literally thousands of Americans, were imprisoned for saying things that they disagreed with President Wilson, or they didn't think we should go to war, or things like that, which, you know, certainly are part of our freedom.
And they slapped them in jail for a long time for opposing the war. And even then, judges thought, well, that's a bad tendency. That doesn't cut it. That's not okay. That's certainly not our understanding today. We've evolved enormously in this century. As you point out, once the judicial understanding of this shifted, it just got one brick after another in building up the foundations of a much more thoroughgoing freedom of expression.
Yes, in my lifetime, actually, the most dramatic change has been in the attitude of political conservatives toward the First Amendment. In the early days, it was always the conservatives, the Federalist Party, or later on in World War I, that were trying to suppress dissenting speech. Then, sometime toward the end of the 20th century, conservatives got the idea that they could benefit from the First Amendment, too. Mm-hmm. They wanted their chance for free speech, and so that there's a pretty universal political belief, at least in the abstract, in freedom of speech today. But when you come to the concrete, like what should we do about supposed terrorists and so on, then there may be, again, division.
Division, but is there today, in your view, you've been watching it for a long time, is there vulnerability for the American public on the freedom of expression front? Do you see that as a right that at this point remains weakly guarded by precedent, by the courts, no, by expectation?
No, I think freedom of speech is in better shape in this country today than it has ever been, or than it is anywhere else in the world. I'm not a pessimist about freedom of speech. But there are other aspects of the First Amendment, especially when it comes to the press. The right of the press to dig out what government's doing, and that is not in such good shape. And since 9/11, there has been a tremendous effort at secrecy and suppression of facts about the war in Iraq, going into that war, about the treatment of prisoners, about torture, and so on, all of which has been a tremendous challenge to the First Amendment, and I think is a great challenge to the press today.
Freedom of speech, in that sense, is what you make of it, or what you're allowed to make of it. Are you saying freedom of the press within this right is shortchanged by the press itself not exercising that freedom fully, or by actual government, you know, a foot on the throat of it?
What a good question. It's both. The government has done what it can. It's a very secretive government, the Bush administration, tremendously secretive, to prevent the press from digging out the facts. But the press has also been rather craven. Indeed, after the Iraq war started, the New York Times and the Washington Post, most unusually, both published apologies for their failure to aggressively disclose what was going on before the war was actually begun. But more recently, I think both papers and the press generally have become they've been readier to exercise their great function as the checkers of government.
As you look at this through the lens of history, it has often, maybe always been particularly threats from abroad or threats to security which are thrust to the fore when it comes to attacks on freedom of speech.
Again and again, it's been, you know, whether it's the fear of communism or the fear of terrorism or the fear of, you know, in the Sedition Act in 1798, most amazingly, the Federalists explained their repressive statute by saying they needed it to stop French Jacobin terrorism from entering the United States.
Good Lord, look for men in berets.
Yes.
But 9/11, kind of the epitome of that. Here was the foreign threat on American soil. And when you look back on balance over this last, what, now going on 7 years, does it look that we've righted ourselves fairly well, that we've acquitted ourselves decently in regard to freedom of speech, expression, press, or you know, has it shifted the
the trend away from that sort of inexorable movement toward more freedom that you describe in the history towards something else. Are you worried about it?
I'm worried about it for one reason. The fundamental fact is that there has not been another great terrorist attack in this country since 9/11. If there were, I think public fear and willingness to have repression would greatly increase sharply and immediately. And whether it was luck or skill that has protected us from that kind of attack, we can all judge. But the underlying tendency toward secrecy is still there, and we still don't know anywhere near enough about the way we got into the war in Iraq, the way we've dealt with detainees, and so on.
So when you look at civil liberties, when you come to that point, executive power, the way we deal with detainees, freedom of expression should help us examine that. But it's broader freedoms that we're suddenly into there. This gets beyond the First Amendment pretty quickly.
Absolutely. The First Amendment is a very important part of the Constitution, and it has preoccupied my life for a long time. But it's not all there is. The right to be free of imprisonment without a reason, the right to be free of torture, these things are very important too. We mustn't neglect them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about freedom of speech and the history of America's difficult relationship with the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment guarantee. My guest is Anthony Lewis, kind of commentator supreme for many decades on issues, legal issues affecting this society at very large. Pulitzer Prize winning twice, longtime columnist and reporter for the New York Times. His new book is Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. And let's turn to our listeners. Albert is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Albert, you're on the air with Anthony Lewis.
Well, may I say, I hope you gentlemen are having a good day. I hope that doesn't sound like it shouldn't be protected speech.
We're having a great day. Speak up as freely as you like, Albert.
Happy to hear it. I'd like to suggest that what you guys have been saying could be expressed also as the time in history, the sweep of events, the necessary support and understanding and mutuality between different parties, the ability and the zeitgeist for the language to be there, to make a statement needs to be there. This thing about the government and secrecy, do we know if it's okay to talk about every prisoner situation? Do we want to know? But yeah, if we got attacked again, then that would make us like the Mujahideen-run countries. In my own personal life, I'm autistic. I'm an adult autistic. I'm a voluntary inpatient in the psych hospital. And to say that I believe personally, not that I'm making others believe, that mental illness and health and alcoholism issues, not that I'm an active alcoholic, but I'm allergic to alcohol, should be seen as a syndrome, not an illness. That when Dr. Bill did the AA thing, that was an improvement over let the bums die. You know, that was the way they folks dealt with it then. They didn't know what else to do, so the AA was an improvement. But syndrome means there's a bunch of different stuff happening. There's feelings, there's opinions, there's physical stuff.
She said the times, the zeitgeist, clearly have a lot to do with our understanding of what exactly we feel we're guaranteed and the vigor with which we exercise those freedoms. Anthony Lewis, you look at this a lot in the book, how the intersection of events, guarantees, and particularly of interpretation. I mean, the courts, after all, are the guarantors in our system here.
Yes, and one of the most amazing things is the way that judges, often dissenting judges, can focus people's beliefs and make them see things they hadn't seen before. The rhetoric of opinions in the Supreme Court, it's hard to say how that can happen in a great large country like this one, but when a judge like Holmes or Brandeis or Justice Black can talk about the value of free speech in powerful language and emotive language, it's very moving to me, and I think it's been to millions of Americans, and it has helped. It's an interplay, as you said, Tom, of public opinion and judicial opinions working against each other and with each other.
You remind us that the American Republic was the first democracy to give the court quite this role, quite such a structural role in determining what the rules would be and how they'd be interpreted.
Actually, to give some credit to where we live, it was the then colony of Massachusetts or state of Massachusetts mm-hmm. after the Revolution mm-hmm. that first enshrined the power of judges, as you've described, to declare what the law was and overrule statutes. That was John Adams wrote the Constitution of Massachusetts, which is still in effect, and it was copied in the federal constitution, and that's what we have.
But it wasn't the case in Britain, wasn't the case in Europe or anywhere else for quite a long time.
Until after World War II. No other country until after World War II gave judges this power to hold the political branches of government to a constitutional standard.
Here's where looking at freedom of speech, as I read through this the wonderful book, Anthony Lewis, illuminates a lot more. While we're following that freedom of expression, we look at how it's been defined over time, the court's role in that, and the debate that goes on over how much flexibility judges ought to have to interpret. I mean, even now, you know, every time it's time to confirm a judge, it's, well, are you going to go by exactly what's written down in the Constitution, or are you going to start making interpretation of your own? You look all the way back to Chief Justice Charles Evan Hughes, who said, 1907, the Constitution is what the judges say it is. Now, even today, that would be flayed in big parts of the American media and political world.
He thought he was just being candid because, you know, when you have language as general as Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or the press, or the Constitution uses words like due process and equal protection, they're not self-defining. The judge has to say what they mean in a concrete case. And, you know, that's just the nature of the business of judges.
But when you hear, and lately it's been often the Republican call for strict constructionist and the appeal to, well, let's have it today just as it was then. What you're describing here would suggest that that's just not in touch with the way our system has actually worked, does actually work, and not just in a contemporary Democratic administrations.
Of course, I think the talk about strict construction is usually just a cover for wanting to reach the results that you like. The conservative-dominated court installed George W. Bush as president in the year 2000 in the case of Bush against Gore, which had no precedent and very little reasoning. And it was a coup d'etat, in essence, a judicial coup d'etat, which the public accepted. But it certainly wasn't strict construction. You know, in any event, I mean, not to make it political, it isn't political. We all do it. All people on all sides interpret the Constitution, because there's no escape from interpreting such general language. And when you do, when you reach a result, mm-hmm. it's going to please some people and not please some other people. And here's the point, I think, about this book. To a startling degree, in the latter part of the 20th century, the Supreme Court justices were agreed on the importance of free speech and an open society. It wasn't a case of dissenters. The great dissents were earlier, mm-hmm. and then that changed. And we now have a situation in which most judges and most people accept the ideal of an open society.
Can we backslide on that front? Do you fear it? Is there precedent for it? People talk about turning back Roe v. Wade. Is freedom of speech in judicial interpretive terms really guaranteed in your view, or could it go the other way?
It could go the other way, depending on crises in the reality sphere. Let me give you an example. When the New York Times disclosed the illegal wiretapping by the Bush administration, mm-hmm. The Bush administration, some people in it, said that was treason. They were very upset at the press performing its duty. Mm-hmm. And when the Washington Post disclosed the secret prisons in which the United States was holding detainees without, mm-hmm. as required by treaty, showing them to representatives of the International Red Cross, the same charge was made. The Washington Post has breached our national security. That was said at the time of the Pentagon Papers case in 1971. The New York Times and the Washington Post have opened us to the North Vietnamese. But it's usually the cries are exaggerated, and what they really mean is we want to do our job in secret. We don't want the public to know what we're doing.
Anthony Lewis' new book is Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. And we have questions large and small, narrow and real and acute. Let's get one right here from Nashville, Tennessee. Victor, you're on the air with Tony Lewis. Have you got a question for our great guru?
Yes, sir. Thank you. This happened locally about 2 months ago, and this happened in two separate occasions, very close together. I was in a local establishment, you know, a restaurant, you know, sitting at the bar having conversation like we always do. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about the war. Every opinion out there was out there. I was told in one establishment by an employee and in another establishment by the owner that I was not allowed to talk about the war or any politics for that matter in their place. And all I can do is basically not go there anymore. But I guess the question is, even though that place is privately run, there is a public gathering of sorts going on there every day. Can they legally tell me to be quiet?
It's a great question, Victor. Stick with us. Tony Lewis, what do you say?
You've anticipated the answer by saying they're privately run. The Constitution applies only to public suppression. That is, Congress shall make no law, or, as it's been interpreted, the state governments can make no law. State governors, presidents can make no law that abridges the freedom of speech of the press. Not bartenders, not tavern owners. They can, I suppose, regulate it, unless there's a state law that says a man who opens a restaurant has to be open to all people. I think it's outrageous. It's ludicrous that he tries to stop you speaking about the war, but it's not a federal case.
Victor, let me ask you, just to give us a sense here, were you getting rowdy about it? Were you throwing beer bottles and shouting at the top of your lungs?
No, we weren't. We were having a very moderate tone conversation. There were no tempers. There was no profanity. There was no obscenity. The more we talked, the more people around us became interested. When it became apparent that this little group was entertaining all opinions, for and against, left and right, it doesn't matter. It was really turning into a textbook example of an open discussion.
So, Tony Lewis, it's not the volume here or rowdiness or perceived threat to order. If the manager or owner simply doesn't want a particular subject discussed, that's within his right unless there's some statute saying
unless there's a state law that tells him he has to let anybody voice an opinion. I mean, I think what you're describing is what James Madison thought this country was all about, open discussion. And it sounds, I can't believe that somebody would try to stop that.
So, Victor, what's your solution? Are you out on the sidewalks with it now or just down the street at another bar?
Well, I just don't go there anymore. And people that I know that were around, all we can do is just locally, if someone says, do you know a good place to eat? Well, we say, well, don't go there because they won't let you talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Well, and that's your freedom of speech, I guess, to say just that. We hope you find a good venue. Let's get another call. Jeff in Bloomfield. Jeff, you're on the air.
Yes, gentlemen, great discussion. Tom, welcome back. I'm glad everything went well for you.
Me too. Thanks very much.
Yeah, I'd like to just address current issues since the Bush administration and since 9/11. When we invaded Afghanistan about a month or two, month and a half after 9/11, there were some young people in Hartford, downtown Hartford, Connecticut, that demonstrated against the war. And they did it without a permit, and there weren't many people, but they caused the scene, and they were all arrested, and their bail was set at $5,000. Now, I'm 57, having demonstrated against the Vietnam War, and a lot of union activity during my adult career, nothing like that has ever happened. That quells dissent.
That size of bail for dissenters, you say, is a wet blanket at the very least.
More than a wet blanket, Tom. Mm-hmm. It's going to make people who are not of means not go in the street and demonstrate. The other thing, there are several other examples. Anywhere Bush appears now, there's a designated area for dissent, very often away from the press, very often away from the president, so he can't be heckled like other politicians have always been.
Right.
Another example is the kind of information that comes out of the Gulf Coast about Katrina and the kinds of things that are going on down there. You know, it's just a skullduggery and secrecy on a grand scale.
What are you suggesting, that the newspapers aren't bringing it or FEMA is squelching it, or what's the problem?
Well, I think that there's a status quo kind of position that's taken by our national government, probably elements of the state government in Louisiana, and I don't think that the real story, the local story out of New Orleans, is getting back, that people from the Ninth Ward are not welcome back. I think that's the essence of it. Another example is after we invaded Iraq, I was going to a grocery store, and I saw some veterans of foreign wars, three gentlemen. They were Immediately, I just said, what do you think about this war? And immediately they said, one of them said immediately, I don't think that anybody, all these young people who want to demonstrate against the war, they ought not to be allowed to demonstrate against the war. And I said, really? He said, yeah. And I said, well, that's kind of good, since we let the Ku Klux Klan walk down Main Street. You don't want these kids to walk down, you know, demonstrate?
So there are always attitudes conflicted about that freedom. Tony Lewis, so what about the potential for, you know, we've got the big grand freedom of speech, but then you get down to the details. Jeff says he sees, you know, bail set so high protesters afraid to go out, designated protest areas when the president's in town.
Well, a designated protest site is just another example of how skillful and determined the Bush administration is to keep dissent down to the extent it can. But your last example of the dissenters on the Iraq War and your conversation with the veterans of foreign wars people just shows you that even in this free speech country, they're always in emergencies or in times of stress. There are always people who want to suppress dissenting speech. That's been true from the beginning, and we just have to be on our guard. It's outrageous. And Hartford was not the only example of arrests of protesters and high bail. It happened in New York, and dissenters from the Iraq War were imprisoned, kept there without really any reason at all for days. And only recently, years later, their arrests have been found to be invalid and the whole thing quite wrong. But meanwhile, they were locked up, and so it happens.
How have you come, over the many years you've paid attention to this, to interpret these conflicting impulses kind of in the American heart here? On the one hand, as you point out, liberals and conservatives have come to embrace freedom of speech at many levels, particularly recently. You look at campaign finance reform, and it's all about freedom of speech. I mean, Americans know at some place in their bones that freedom of speech is key, and at the same time, on a given issue, on a given day, we'll try and shut someone down who's saying something they don't like. We hold these conflicting impulses. Is that always the way it must be, or does it ever get resolved?
No, it doesn't ever get totally resolved. Life is not so neat. We've made a lot of progress, but that progress is always subject to interruption or rollback in times of stress. Attacks by terrorists, fear of communism, fear of terrorism. You know, we just have to be on our guard. And when a government, as this one has, will say that a newspaper reporter who gets a really important story about the Americans torturing prisoners, that to me is really an important story and a disgrace to our nation. They say, well, he's violated national security, or he's a traitor, or whatever. You have to just stand fast. And the press especially, and it's learned this lesson bitterly, has not to cringe, but to say, no, we're going to stick to it and do our job.
We'll report it, no matter how unwelcome it may sound at the moment, no matter how unwelcome it may be with the powers that be.
Exactly.
And post 9/11, well, it's been kind of confessed on the front page. People quailed.
You got time for a quote from Hugo Black?
Yes.
Justice Black, in the Pentagon Papers case, when the New York Times disclosed the secret history of the Vietnam War and the Nixon administration tried to stop publication, Justice Black in the Supreme Court wrote, "The press was protected in the First Amendment so that it could bear the secrets of government and inform the people. Only a free and unrestrained press can effectively expose deception in government. And paramount among the responsibilities of a free press is the duty to prevent any part of the government from deceiving the people and sending them off to distant lands to die of foreign fever."
Tony Lewis, hold it right there. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about freedom of speech and the history of America's difficult relationship with the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment guarantee. Maybe nobody knows that guarantee better than Anthony Lewis, two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize, longtime columnist for the New York Times, celebrated commentator and interpreter of that nexus between our Constitution and our society. His new book is Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment, and it tells really, for a long time, kind of tortured history of the First Amendment, how long it took for us to really embrace it, and the step-by-step fleshing out of that guarantee in real time, in real circumstances, by the Supreme Court, largely, of this country. And Tony Lewis, I interrupted no less than Hugo Black there, just going into the break, but you were just about to come to the climax of his observation on how we hold and observe this freedom.
Well, Justice Black, you was talking about the role of the press, and he used a wonderful Southern phrase, as I've learned, said it's the duty of the press to prevent the government from deceiving the people and sending them off to distant lands to die of foreign fevers and foreign shot and shell. It's a great phrase. What I like about this
subject... Hello, Fallujah.
Yeah. What I like about this subject is it's all stories. We've come to our understanding of freedom through the struggles of individuals and their stories. Indeed, the very title of my book, Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, comes from an opinion of Justice Holmes about a woman, Rosika Schwimmer, who came to this country from Hungary, loved the United States, wanted to become a citizen. She couldn't. She was not allowed to because the form then required her to swear that she would take up arms in defense of the Constitution. And she lost in the Supreme Court, but Justice Holmes, dissenting, said, well, it's very unlikely that she would be asked to take up arms, as she's a woman of a certain age. And he didn't agree with her pacifism, but he said, if there is any principle of the Constitution that more imperatively calls for attachment than any other, it is the principle of free thought. Not free thought for those who agree with us, but freedom for the thought that we hate. And, you know, the story of Rosika Schwimmer really brings to life what passion can be involved in this subject and why I care for it so much.
Take us around again, because it deserves repeating kind of in every generation, every time we touch it, how those who have thought so deeply over so long about this freedom of speech and the freedom for the thought that we hate, how they come to see the thought that we hate, the one that we find most repulsive, as somehow at the same time key to the health of our very democracy, of our political system. Why? Why that thought?
Well, you know, it's an oddity, but an inescapable one, that very often the cases that have guaranteed our freedom, not only freedom of speech, have been brought to the Supreme Court by people who are eccentrics or not very nice, who are members of the Ku Klux Klan or the American Nazi Party or the American Communist Party or this or that. The great case on the right to counsel, the Gideon case, was brought there by a poor prisoner, a five-time loser, a complete nobody, and it was good for everybody, good for the exaltation of this country. So that's the way the system works, and I love it.
You write about how it was the experience of the rise of Nazi Germany that helped Europe and much of the world come around to this American view that we need to protect speech. We can't simply leave the way we behave, the rules we make, to the majority.
Yes, that was wonderfully expressed by the then Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Israel, Aharon Barak, who said the rule used to be, in a sort of supercilious or rather elevated, that's not done. But then he said, after the experience of the Nazis, we thought it was necessary to write into constitutions, enforced by courts, the rule, you can't do it.
Not just it's something we would never do, because the unthinkable had been done, could
exactly,
be done.
Exactly.
And so there's the role of the court. There's the Constitution lifted up. There's the absolute clear guarantee. This won't be done no matter what you or even a majority believe, because our first principles forbid it.
As Chief Justice Barak said, democracy is not just majority vote. It's majority vote and protection of the minority. That's what has made America survive and what's so important for us today.
We have lots of callers here. Let's go to Ian in Franklin, Massachusetts. Ian, you're on the air with Tony Lewis.
Hi. Hi, Tom. Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment and a question. In October of 2007, the U.S. House of Representatives voted in favor, 4-4-6, of this bill called the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Act of 2007. And it states it's designed to prevent, quote, the process of adopting or promoting an extremist belief system for the purpose of facilitating ideologically based violence to advance political, religious, or social change. So my question is, in the face of future crisis, whether it be from terrorism, economic, or environmental crisis, do you think the U.S. government will further crack down on free speech and possibly even criminalize beliefs and ideology, as this bill appears to do?
I'm not familiar with the particular bill.
I'm not familiar with the bill either, but it doesn't sound very good to me. I mean, it sounds as though it's an attempt to suppress speech we don't like. If it is truly a violent speech, I mean, that is a speech which, as the Supreme Court has put it, the speaker urges people to commit violence and they and there's a real risk they will rush out and do so, then that's one thing. But if it's just a general, extremist speech, I wouldn't be in favor of that. And I'm rather surprised it passed the House, as you say, and I hope it's not applied casually.
Mm. Let's take a call from Ruth in Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Ruth. You're on the air.
Hi, Professor Lewis. I'm from South Africa, where we have a constitution that has a limitation clause, and that enables government to limit the freedom of speech for what they claim is needed for the sake of equality. And then the Constitutional Court interprets the balance between freedom and equality. I have two opposing questions about America. What is your constitutional mechanism that is used here for government to limit the freedom of speech? And the other question is, what can government do if the people that they're scared want to harm the citizens of the country will use the freedoms that they grant them to ensnare the state or your country?
It's a very interesting question, Ruth, and I'm familiar with the South African Constitution. Every country has to approach these problems in terms of its own history. After the legacy of apartheid and brutal racial discrimination, it's understandable that in writing the new constitution, the framers of that South African constitution did not extend freedom of speech to racist or discriminatory speech, speech that argued for inequality, as you put it. Similarly, in Germany, which has the modern Germany post-World War II, has a very good constitution and a wonderful constitutional court that guarantees free speech, but not for Nazis. They've had an experience which makes them not trust that particular kind of hateful speech. In our case, we have happily survived with only occasional, and I've mentioned those, occasional repressive waves in World War I, the fear of communism, the fear of terrorism. And the mechanism is only individual cases. It's when someone like Rosika Schrimmer comes along and her case is heard by the Supreme Court. The courts decide what the balance is between freedom of speech and other interests, which may be the interest of privacy or the interest of equality. There are other interests in life, and very often conflicts have to be settled by the courts.
But Ruth is saying, here we have a constitution in South Africa, and it's not the only one, that has a kind of built-in emergency brake on all this, saying under extreme circumstances, here it is in black and white, what can be done and how we do it. You write, Tony Lewis, in your book, that the other countries we think of as like our own, Britain, for example, have many more restrictions on what can be said. When the United States, without those restrictions generally, faces a 9/11-type situation, and does it have options? When people feel absolutely urgently that they need some restraint, some restriction, something that seems extra constitutional, does it all rely on either a president like George Bush who's willing just to go ahead essentially and do it, or a Supreme Court that's willing to comply and develop a rationale on the hoof? Or do we have kind of standing tools through interpretation over time that are available to grab? What?
There isn't a clear answer. There isn't a rule book where you can look up the answer. It's going to be up to the courage and imagination of judges in the end. If they give way to the cry of urgency, whether it comes from Congress or the president, then we'll have repression. And the courts have not been perfect in standing up to those cries of urgency and those repressive waves. They do sometimes, and it's difficult. I mean, for example, this isn't a free speech example, but the question of the treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo. The court has spoken twice on that issue, and there's another case before the court right now on which argument's been heard. And it takes a lot of courage to stand up to a president who says this is a national security urgency.
And so we make it up as we go, but that body of law and interpretation stands there, we hope, as a kind of bulwark along the way.
I hope so.
Brenda's calling from Jackson, South Carolina. Hi, Brenda. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I agree with Mr. Lewis completely about the danger of a lazy and or colluding press. But my greatest fear for free speech comes from the American people themselves. I belong to two local peace organizations, and the first and third Mondays we stand a regular vigil for peace. And the things that people yell at us, other than the profanity and calling us names and telling us we need to die and burn in hell, sometimes people will actually stop and get out of their vehicles and tell us that if we don't like what our government does, if we don't like this war, we should move to Iran or North Korea or China, love it or leave it, in other words. An ex-Marine was jogging past the other day, and at that point there were only women in the group, and he told us to get into them red burkas. And it's the thought or the sentiment that any expression of opposition is un-American.
What about their expression of opposition to your view, Brenda? Are you ready to stand up for that? He's got a sense of humor at least, but you know, get into them red burkas, that's freedom of expression too, isn't it?
Yes, it is, absolutely. And I support their right to yell at us anything they want to, but I don't support their right to tell us not to be there. Well, I guess they have a right to tell us not to be there, but my concern is that they want to tell us not to be there. They stop and engage us in a debate about the war, but that they feel that we have no right to express opposition is what I find frightening.
Well, I think it is frightening, and I salute your courage, Brenda, for doing what you do despite these rather unpleasant, to put it mildly, attacks, verbal attacks. Speech can be hateful. That's a fact. And there's very little tolerance in time of war and emergency. Or there may be little tolerance among some people. Of course, it's regional. If you did that in Massachusetts, if you did what you're doing down there in Massachusetts, people would not assault you verbally. And it's a local phenomenon, but it's very hurtful. I understand, and I repeat, I salute you.
Let's take a call from a truck driver in Tyngsborough, Massachusetts. Robin, you're on the air with Anthony Lewis.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm actually in New Hampshire now, but
okay. Keep on trucking.
It's just a little box truck. I was curious as to what your guest feels about the Supreme Court equating political contributions with free speech.
I've never agreed with that decision. It was actually political expenditures with free speech.
Remind us how far that goes back. When was this decision?
Oh,
well, sorry.
it's a long time back, 20 years. Mm-hmm. Buckley against Vallejo is the name of the case. My great hero of constitutional law, Professor Paul Freund of the Harvard Law School, said, they say that money talks. I thought that was the problem, not the solution. I agreed with him. I thought it was too simple-minded to say that spending was just another form of speech. It is important, but there's no other country on earth that allows unlimited campaign spending. You know, the reason that Mitt Romney can go on as he does is because there's no limit on what you can spend of your own money. The Supreme Court held it was unconstitutional to regulate spending your own money. I didn't agree with that, and I still don't.
But people could say, well, the reason Ralph Nader goes on as he does, because there's no limit to what you can say with your determination, you know, to how long you can express yourself.
It's not a one-track issue.
Do you see malleability on that? Is that set in stone? If Congress continues to push and raises occasional pushback on that, is there room for that interpretation of money as free speech to go the other way, or is that settled law, as they say?
I think it's pretty settled, unfortunately, because I don't agree with it. But just recently, a year ago, the Supreme Court whittled away at at what it had allowed Congress to regulate. The new conservative majority on the Supreme Court went the other way from what you're saying, Tom, and I don't think it's going to happen soon that we have more campaign spending regulation.
Tony Lewis, we've got just a minute left. It's an election year. You're in your 80th year. We've got a kind of maybe change in the winds. We don't know. You know, a pendulum swings. Where do you see it now on American civil liberties, their commitment to expressing and defending those? Are you optimistic or something else?
I'm an optimist by nature, and I think civil liberties are deep in the American bones, despite all the setbacks we've had. And I think that if there is a change of administration, you will see a great relaxation of some of the limits that have been put on finding out about torture and detention and so on. But you never want to underestimate the tendency of government, any government, to keep its work secret, because it's much easier to do your job in secret with nobody criticizing you, nobody knowing what you're doing. So we can't expect perfection.
There's a voice for hope and a lot of illumination of history at the same time in Anthony Lewis's new book, Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. Tony Lewis, great to have you with us again. Thanks very much for all your work on this, and thanks for your time today. Wonderful to have you here.
A pleasure to be here.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.